I did not finish the second set of notes last week. We got into it and didn't get quite finished it, and so I will finish that up. So if you had a copy from last week, you'll want to get that out. It's the one titled Live Right, and it says Job 2 up on the left-hand corner. And we're actually on page 3 of that set of notes. And I looked on the back table, and there are none back there, so if you didn't get a copy and you want a copy, you'd have to check with my wife and she could print you up sometime in the future. We're on page 3, and we are just starting to talk about Job's character, as there is a very good description of the type of man that Job was, which is helpful, I think, in understanding the problem that Job went through in his trials, to understand and realizing that God was not chastising him. Now, there is a difference, and that's where it's always difficult when things go wrong. Sometimes God allows things or even causes things to go wrong to discipline us or to chasten us. It says in Hebrews 12, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. And that is true. But not every time someone has a problem and things go wrong does that mean God is chastening or disciplining them. As the case of Job, that wasn't what was happening. And as we'll note in the text as we get into it a little further, Job was a very, really upstart, godly man. And yet, Satan is the one that brought about the problems against him in his life. And we need to understand that those same things can happen to us. We're not exempt from that. In fact, I believe that really is the total intent of the book of Job and God putting it in the Bible for our understanding so that we would understand sometimes when we go through things is that literally it is Satan that is trying to discourage us and tries to get us to give up and will even go so far to get us to curse the name of God. That's Satan's trick, and that's what we find in the book of Job. So the first thing I'm going to do here is talk about Job's character. The first chapter presents an introduction to Job. It describes his home, his character, his wealth, and his godly disposition. The chapter also presents the intriguing and insightful dialogue between Satan and God regarding Job. Few places in the Bible contain such insight. The chapter then describes the calamities which befell Job and which were allowed by God. The chapter concludes with Job's reaction, showing his just nature and godly maturity. And that paragraph is a very good description of what you find in Job chapter 1 and some of it in chapter 2. According to Jewish history, and by Jewish history we mean the traditions, not the Bible, but the traditions that have been passed down through the ages in Jewish history, Job was considered to be 70 years old when the heavy trials actually came upon him. And then he lived 100 and some years after that, so he lived actually a little over 200 years of age. I think one of the things that's important to understand in relationship to that, the age does not exempt us from suffering. It can be brought upon us at any age. Young person, middle age, old age. I suppose when we get a little older, and I'm a little prejudiced there, but as we get a little older, I'd like to think, well, I've lived through all that, I don't have to do it anymore. But sorry, it really does not work that way. There is no age in particular that those things can be brought upon us. So Job actually was getting up in years, although we're in the period of time, we believe, where there was longevity was common yet. That he would live that long, but even then, 70 years and then have such terrible things go wrong was quite devastating. He had a good reputation. Let's read Job 1:1. There was a man in the land of Uz, and we talked about that last week, whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and eschewed evil. We'll take a little bit of time to talk about each one of those phrases and words as it describes his good reputation. First of all, it says he was perfect and upright. The word perfect obviously does not mean sinless. And of course, we realize and understand from the studying of Scripture, besides the fact that we know ourselves pretty well, there is no such thing as a sinlessly perfect person. And so that could not be the meaning of the word, and obviously that's not the meaning. So it does not mean to be sinless, but it means one who actually is complete, one who has lived life to the point of doing it successfully, to not just be lacking in a lot of areas, but actually have matured spiritually to the point where they are somewhat complete in themselves. And that, again, is something that you would find a little more, probably, in someone that has lived life as a believer, has done so successfully to the glory of God, and as a result of that, you could say that they have learned to endure, or they have lived a life that is complete, or is the word that is used here, perfect and upright. So he was complete in his dedication to God. And I think, again, you have to come to the conclusion as you read chapter 1, even chapter 2, that he was a very dedicated man. He honored God in the abilities and things of which he had. You have to understand with Job that he didn't have this. He didn't have the advantage that we have to have the written word of God. He wouldn't have even had Genesis, as far as we know, other than what the traditions might have been, as far as people repeating the history. The scripture indicates that Moses actually penned Genesis in the five books of the law, though he would have had a knowledge of those things, obviously. But beyond that, the law had not been given, so he didn't even have the law. So he didn't have the things that we have, and yet he was a very dedicated man in the knowledge of which he had of spiritual things. The same word is actually translated when it talks about the sacrificial offerings as without spot and blemish, referring to the animal sacrifices. When they were to bring their sacrifices, they were to be without spot and blemish. And especially on the Passover day, as recorded there in Exodus chapter 12, I believe it is, but where it records they were to take the lamb and set it aside for several days to make sure that it was not sick and that it could not have any injuries, it couldn't have any broken bones, and they were to observe those things in particular. And so with the sacrifices, usually they referred to as without spot or blemish. Now, if you think about that, that did not mean that the animal without spot and blemish was perfect, because all they had was what they could see on the outside and what they could examine on the outside. That lamb that they observed to be without spot and blemish could have had something wrong internally. It could have even had a disease, maybe, and they wouldn't know that it had a disease. All they could judge is what they could see on the outside, so it does not mean that that animal was absolutely perfect. Might have been, but it might not have been. So that gives us, I think, a sense of understanding what the word is referring to. As far as Job could be observed, he was godly. You wouldn't see things. And, of course, we can look at each other, the same thing in life, and say, well, there's really a godly person. But the difference is, you don't see me inside. I wish sometimes I didn't. But, you know, that really describes it. We know ourselves, if we're honest with ourselves, we aren't absolutely perfect. Now, to others, we might appear to be a pretty good guy. But, obviously, again, in understanding and realizing that, that describes Job. He was a man who was complete. As you would observe him, he was certainly an upright man. Job had an impeccable reputation, blameless, actually, before others. It's almost a little bit as Noah was described. Go back to Genesis chapter 6 and verse 9. The day of which the flood took place, Noah was described in this way, which is an interesting description. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 9, verse 8, but Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. And so you have really a very similar description there of Job, or of Noah in particular, and much like you have a description here of Job being perfect and upright. The second expression that is used there, a sound relationship with God, it says that he was upright in verse 1. Job had a righteous standing with God. Job was a man who did what was right. Man is only as good on the outside as he is on the inside. In the Old Testament times, a person was justified by faith, just as a person is justified by faith today. Job had placed his faith in God based on information God revealed through his chosen patriarchs. One of the interesting things about the Old Testament scriptures, which always leaves things a little puzzling in our minds, because we are so used to the New Testament scriptures where it talks about being saved. And so in the New Testament, you also have accounts of people like the Philippian jailer that got saved. They said, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and I shall be saved." And he did believe and he got baptized, and we have a testimony of that. But in the Old Testament, it just very seldom everyone uses that terminology, and it's hard to distinguish because of different characters. Were they really saved or were they not saved? It's just not that plain in the Old Testament. Last night in devotions, my wife and I read about Manasseh, King Manasseh, who was considered to be the wickedest king that the southern kingdom, Judah, had. And the things he did, they brought in idolatry, they had the sacrifice of the children to Molech, and all of these absolutely horrible things. But after he was shipped out of there and taken captive at Babylon, while he sat over in Babylon, he repented and turned to the Lord, and finally God allowed him to come back to his throne. So there was a change there, and we were talking about that last night. Was he saved when he did all these terrible things, or did he get saved in Babylon? I don't know, because it doesn't say. But here again, as you look at Job, was Job saved? Well, obviously he was, because it describes his character. He was an upright man. Though again, it doesn't use what we would call New Testament terminology about that in particular. But he was upright and respected man, so obviously he was truly a saved man. The next phrase is respect for God. It says, "and one that feared God." Why did Job enjoy a good reputation? I think the key is here because he feared God. The fear of God refers to awe, overwhelming respect, reverence, the acknowledgement that God is truly God. It's always a little bit hard to define what it is to fear God, but I think that's a pretty good definition of it in particular, to simply have that kind of awe and respect for God and realize who he actually is. He had a definite fear of God. When you get into the aspect of the fact, and we'll talk about that here in just a little bit, that he gave sacrifice for his children, he would not have done that if he didn't fear God. He was concerned about his kids. As the father, the head of the family, really as the priest of the family, he gave those sacrifices, but that indicates he did that as out of a respect, a reverence for God, an obedience to God. He truly had a fear of God. And that's what's always puzzling, because the fear of God doesn't mean you sit and you shake in your boots, but it simply means that our respect and reverence for God as it should be, which affects how we live. Then, point number D there, his resistance towards sin, and also in verse 1 it says that he eschewed evil. In other words, he had a dislike for things that were wrong. He hated evil. He spoke out against evil. He did not do evil things himself. I've just added some thought here from a couple verses. Proverbs 8:13, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil." We just talked about the fact that he feared God. In the book of Proverbs, Solomon said, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil." And I think that describes Job. He was a man who disliked wickedness. He hated evil. James 4:4, Pastor Brown had gone through that just recently. "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity," or enemies with God. "Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." So again, if we're going to be a friend of God, what do? We hate evil. We don't participate in sin. We dislike that. We stay away from it. We avoid it. That was Job. He hated evil. He eschewed evil. Job preferred fellowship with God over fellowship with the world. He chose to distance himself from sinful practices and to draw near to God. Job's circumstances then in verse 2 and 3. There was born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 she-asses or donkeys, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all of the men of the East. Which is a rather interesting description of Job and how, what his position actually was in life. We do not usually expect rich and famous people to be righteous and devout. Now, they can be, but generally speaking, a lot of people who are rich and famous don't have any time for God. Not always. There have been some godly people that did have great wealth. But it's possible for a wealthy and a famous person to lead a godly life, and Job is a good example of that. No matter how you count the donkeys, he was a wealthy man. He had a lot of possessions. Job's wealth began, first of all, with his family, and that's the way it's described. It tells you about his family, and that really was his greatest wealth. A good family life is really a very rich possession. As it tells us here, he had 7 sons, and he had 3 daughters. How many of them were married, and the in-laws that were really not filled in there, but his immediate family was 7 sons and 3 daughters. How did Job provide for such a large family? Well, he controlled or he owned a large portion of land. Whether he owned it, rented it, or used it, we don't know. But to take care of that many animals, there had to have been a lot of land, actually, to take care of them. In fact, he had 7,000 sheep to provide for food and clothing. They would have used that for food, besides make their clothing they worn from the sheep's wool, and maybe even use the hides. He had 3,000 camels, and the biggest thing that camels were used for would have been for export and import. So evidently he carried on some kind of trade in other places because he had all of those camels. He had 500 yoke of oxen, which actually means that he would have had 1,000 oxen. The oxen were normally used to farm with. They would use those to plow, which would indicate then that he had a lot of tillable land that was able to grow crops on, which would be needed for his family and probably for export and other things. He had 500 female donkeys that were used probably for general labor in different ways. And to handle all of this, he also had to have had servants. There's no way that Job and his 7 sons could have taken care of all of those animals. It was an impossibility. But it uses the expression there that he had a very great household. So evidently, though it is not literally stated that way, he must have had a great number of servants that handled all of these animals and took care of them and did those things in particular, which again explains a little bit of his wealth. Then it says he was the greatest of all of the men of the East. We assume when it says the East, because generally, the Bible is centered around the Mideast and around Israel. So we would assume from that that it would use that expression that the land of Uz, where he lived, was to the east of Israel somewhere, and would have been in those territories in particular. But it says that he was the greatest, and I would include then the idea that he evidently was the most wealthy man in that whole area. And that isn't hard to figure out because of the description of what we just went through, the possessions that he had. Then we have Job's care for his children in verse 4 and 5. Verse 4, and his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now, there's several things that I think should be pointed out in particular in relationship to what's stated here. First of all, we note the closeness of Job's family. They were a family that got together and did things together. The phrase that says there, "everyone his day," may mean, or it may suggest the idea that on each of their birthdays, the family got together. doesn't say birthdays, but each on his own day would tend to indicate that that possibly is the kind of thing in which they had family occasions, which to this day, that's kind of common for families. This was not a one-time thing, but again, it indicates the fact that these things were done continually. So we're not just talking about one event. This was a common thing that happened. It seems obvious that the brothers had their own homes, as it talks about inviting the sisters, and that possibly the sisters were not married yet and were still at home. Though again, it's not spelled out in particular about that, but that seems to be what it indicates, that the single sisters were invited to the home where they would get together and they would have a party. And it talks about them eating and drinking. And may I also remind you, because it uses the term drink, does not mean, nor does it actually even suggest, that they were drinking alcohol. Now, I realize in Wisconsin culture, when people have their parties and families get together, that's just assumed they're going to drink beer. This wasn't Wisconsin. This was in the East. Second, we notice that Job took to spiritual leadership his family and offered sacrifices for them. It says, thus did Job continually, meaning that this was a regular occurrence. I think the regular occurrence of the fact that the families got together, a regular occurrence that Job was concerned for them, so he would offer sacrifices on behalf of his family. Now, that also tells us something in particular. That tells us that there were no Levitical priests. That places the book of Job somehow before Exodus. So before the law was ever given, because once the law was given, you have the Levites. They were the only ones that could actually do the sacrificing and so on. But this was something that was commonly done as a family practice. I think the best example of that, that is similar to this, is when Noah came out of the ark. When Noah came out of the ark, what was the first thing he did? He took the clean animals, he gave a sacrifice to God. It does not say that his sons did. That doesn't mean that his sons weren't spiritual. It simply means he acted as the priest for his family. And so that was his duty as the head of the family to offer that sacrifice for them, that continual blood sacrifice, which all of it goes clear back to Adam and Eve when they came out of the Garden of Eden. When God killed an animal and shed its blood and clothed them with the skins of animals, that was the beginning of the animal sacrifice. And so it was normally the father's responsibility to lead in taking care of his family. And that's what Job was doing. He was taking that duty and responsibility to provide a sacrifice for his family, which again indicates the nature of Job, that he was an upright and godly man. He was concerned for his family. And as it talks about the fact there, in case they might have sinned and said something like cursed God, they might have mocked God in some way, or whatever might have happened. And bear in mind, his kids were human. So, yes, they would have sinned from time to time. Now, we're perfect. We don't sin, so we wouldn't have done that. No, not true. We understand that quite well. And so that's why he was concerned. It was a continual thing that he did on the behalf and benefit of his children. Of course, we do understand that all of the blood sacrifices of the Old Testament were pointing down the road to the day that Christ would shed his blood on the cross of Calvary for us. In conclusion, just to this section, it must be noted that Job was a very godly man, had suffered a terrible trial. If someone does not seem to suffer much for trials, it does not mean that he is spiritual. If someone suffers great trials, it does not mean that he's not living for the Lord. So don't make judgments of people that aren't fair. 1 Peter 4:12, Peter said, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trials which are to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you." I know our human nature, when things go wrong, we begin to think, why me? We should say, why not me? Think it not strange concerning the fiery trials that are to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. Good verse. James 1:12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation or trials. For when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. So there actually is a blessing to those that do endure trials and go through them. Now let's move to the new notes. We won't get through them, but we handed out this morning. I trust that you have them there in hand. This one I entitled as Satan is our enemy, and we begin to get into the fact of what transpired with Satan before God and the accusations about Job. I'm using a word there that is called theodicy. Theo refers to God. The dike refers to justice. So we're talking about justification for God's action and allowing evil to exist. That's what we're talking about here with the story of Job, the justification of God in allowing these things to happen to Job. There seems to be a paradox between the justice of God and the evil in human suffering. God is absolutely just and He's sovereign, yet evil and suffering occur. We'd like to think the two don't go together. The story of Job gives us a view in heaven so we can understand human suffering from a divine perspective. And I think this again is given so that we understand why we go through the things and what happens and what brings them about. I'm not going to take time to go back and review those. We did cover that in the first lesson from Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, which we believe is a description of Satan's fall from heaven. When Satan said, "I will be like the Most High," he decided he was going to be God, and it was due to that fact that he was cast out of heaven and the angels with him. And as we'll note here in particular, what God holds him accountable for even to this day. Verse 6 of chapter 1, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them." The term sons of God is a term for angels. Turn to Job 38. This is partially where we get that. Job 38 actually transpired after the four different individuals had confronted Job and told him, "Job, you've sinned and you need to repent of your sin," which was really not the problem. And then God spoke to Job on this particular occasion. And by the time God got done with him, I'm sure he felt pretty little. But to Job 38:4, he says, "Where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measure thereof? If thou knowest, or who hath stretched the line upon it, whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" And he's talking about creation. Who measured it? Who laid it out? God did. Verse 7, "When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy, or who shut up the sea with the doors when it brake forth, as if it had issued out of the womb." Again, describing some of creation. But verse 7 is the verse I'm after here, when it's referring to the angels as those, the stars that sang together. That's where people get the idea and they look up and they see a star that's an angel, which is not true. But they're described simply as the morning stars. And evidently, in every act of creation, every time God created something and it was finished, and he said it was good, the choirs of heaven, the angels, sang in praise to what God did. And then the second expression, "and all of the sons of God shouted for joy," which would, again, we would understand that step by step in the original creation that these sons of God not only sang, but they shouted for joy. And from that, we would understand that it's referring then actually to angels. Only as we get into it here, we realize they have to be fallen angels, that when Satan fell, they had to be angels that fell with him in particular. So that's where the term sons of God comes in here in particular. We know that Satan and some of those angels fell and were cast out of heaven. It also seems plain that they are required to give regular account to God. Let's go back. We read this before, but back up to Revelation 12. Again, I think this helps us to understand what's going on here in Job. Revelation 12 and verse 10, "And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now has come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. Now, in this passage in Revelation, this is talking about during the 7 years of tribulation, Satan is finally kicked out of heaven, never again, I think, to report to God, where then he does his things that he tries to do when finally he's cast into hell forever, as described in Revelation. But it does give you a vivid description. He is referred to as the accuser of our brethren, which is, accuses them before God day and night. Now, understanding that, you come back to Job. This is exactly what transpires in the life of Job, that Satan and the sons of God, the fallen angels that fell with him, they come before God and have to give a report of their activity. They accuse the brethren, or they literally, from time to time, accuse us before God. The first time that Satan, the word name Satan, is actually used in the Bible is in 1 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 1. The second time is actually here in the book of Job. However, if Job is the older book, it then would be the first mention of his name as Satan. The name means adversary or accuser. Verse 7, and the Lord said unto Satan, from whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. That again is a very helpful verse. It helps us to understand exactly what the devil is doing today. The devil is not sitting on a throne in hell with fire lipping up about him. He's not sitting there in a red suit with horns and a pitchfork tail. Now, you may have seen that in some artist's conception of Satan, but that is not true. He has never been in hell. That is yet coming. But he literally is free to roam throughout the earth. He's not free to go live in heaven, although he has to go to heaven to report to God, but his domain is actually on the earth, and this describes it quite well. He is constantly roaming to and fro throughout the earth, trying to destroy what God has created, and that's the report that he gives. I think this indicates also the fact that he is required to give a report. God asks Satan, what have you been doing? I take it that that means he has to give an accountability to God in exactly what he is doing. He can never do any more than God allows him to do, of which we'll note here as we talk about Job. He did a lot of terrible things to Job, but he could only do what God allowed him to do. There was always a line drawn. And I think we have to understand that that would be true for any of us, as he would accuse us before God. But he is required to give a report to God. His answer was that he was going to and fro throughout the earth as a predator. He roams the earth looking for spiritual prey. Two New Testament verses that I think tie into this that help understand it. In Ephesians 2:2, there Satan is referred to as the prince and power of the air, which again, his domain is the atmosphere around the earth. He's going to and fro, trying to figure out what he can do to destroy and mess up what God has created. And he does a pretty good job of messing things up. We can figure that out without any problem. But he is the prince and power of the air. Or 2 Corinthians 4:4, he's called the god of this world. Now, you look at the world, the unsaved people, and you say, how can they do the things they do? It's because they have a god, Satan. He's the god of a lot of people. Now, that doesn't mean they necessarily get involved in seances and things like that. But there's a lot of people, the devil's just got a ring in their nose, and he just leads them all over the place. And sometimes they think they're doing what's good. And they're just allowing the devil to lead them about, but he is the god of this world. This world is Satan's domain, but he evidently is required to give periodic account to God. I have no idea if that's daily, weekly, monthly. I have no idea, but the scripture, I think, is plain that God says, what have you been doing? He makes him report. And we would have to assume that with that, the demons that fell with him must have some accountability in the same way. In verse 8 we read, and the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there's none like him in the earth, a perfect man, an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil. One of the interesting things here is that it wasn't that Satan asked God about Job. God brought Job up to the devil. God said, have you considered my servant Job? So God asked Satan if he had observed this righteous man living down on the earth, this Job. God is the one who brought Job up, so it was his divine plan for Job to be tested. As much as maybe we don't like that, might make us shudder a little bit if you put our name in there. But nevertheless, it is true, it was God's plan to allow Job to go through this particular testing. God reminded Satan of Job's four characteristics. As we already studied in our lesson this morning back in verse 1, he was a perfect man, he was an upright man, he was one that feared God, he was one that eschewed or hated evil. Job might have been chosen because there were not many of his spiritual character. There might not have been a whole lot of people like him. Maybe that's why he was chosen. I don't know, but God is the one that brought up the subject.